There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and as always, I'm so glad that you can join me for a little bit of classic cardboard conversation. And honestly now, what else would you be doing today? I think I can safely say, while it is cliche to say that we're all in the same boat, we truly are all in the same boat. And we are also frantically paddling with our hands right now. So make sure you use extra soap when you're washing those hands for 20 seconds at a time. But hopefully we can be a pleasant, positive distraction for you. And we had planned on this particular show for weeks. Of course, the world's changed quite a bit in the last couple of weeks, especially here in North America. But we certainly hope that we can be a positive distraction. With that said, I do have some comments about the coronavirus, the COVID-19 that is sweeping across the world right now. We'll get to that in a moment. But let me tell you a little bit about the show. We've got a whole lot of fun stuff going on. The main topic, as we've started doing, we did this last year. I should have done it the previous 2 or 3 years that I've done this podcast. And that is taking a look at the new Topps Heritage set and comparing it to the set that it models, which is 49 years old every year, and really doing more of a deeper dive into the original set. But it's a nice little cross over, a little bit of a Venn diagram overlap of new and old baseball cards. And we normally don't talk about new cards or new releases that often here. But I like doing this because I've always said I've thought Topps Heritage has done a great job throughout the years of not only replicating the original set, but also adding a few little twists and bells and whistles to not only, you know, kind of reintroduce older sets to collectors, but also to, you know, add some stuff that collectors are looking for today, such as variations and refractors and inserts and stuff like that. So we will be looking at the 2020 Topps Heritage set, which is based on the classic 1971 Topps set. And I'll be waxing more nostalgic on the 71 set, but to talk a little more about the Heritage set as well as the base set, which came out several weeks ago, and some other products that are still out there, some may be delayed because of the coronavirus, is our good friend Nick Deonte, who is a contributor to Forbes magazine. He is also a physical education teacher in New York City, and he was telling me when we did the interview a few days ago about how interesting it is to do online distance learning, homeschooling for physical education. It's a lot harder than it sounds because you can't exactly just, you know, go on a webcam and go, all right, give me 20 jumping jacks. You know, there's got to be some very constructive creation of some kind of classwork here. But he's outside of doing all of that stuff. He is a contributor to Forbes, like I said. And also, I guess you can call him an influencer with Topps. Topps finds people who are involved in the hobby, and they will occasionally send these people advanced product. And just looking for good comments, looking for ratings, reviews, and of course these influencers help other people buy into these products. Nick's been doing that for a few years. So he's had his hands on the base set, also the Heritage set, and a couple of the other ones that are just out there, but again, the rest of the product line may be delayed a little bit, you know, much like baseball is delayed and sports are delayed right now. So we've got Nick Deonte joining us a little bit later on in the podcast, and also a very special guest who is a big reason why I've gotten back into baseball cards over the last, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. Even though I slowly got into it about 15 years ago, I definitely increased my consumption of it When my son, Patrick, turned about 4 or 5 years old, I introduced cards to him, and it's been a fun father-son thing that we've been doing for several years now. He's 10 now. He's at home like pretty much every other school kid is, and he will be discussing with me a little bit about his thoughts of the Heritage set, also the classic 1971 set. And if you look at the video link that we posted on Thursday on YouTube, if you aren't already following the channel, it's my own personal channel. You can type in Matt Salmon and you can find it. But also, if you just go to YouTube and you type in Wax Ecstatic 1971-2020 Topps Heritage Break, you will see we opened up a pack of Topps Heritage, a fab pack, but also I just pulled out from random from my binder just a page of 71 Topps cards. And I say at random, but you know, I did put a little thought into it because the way some of my cards are, because I, you know me, I pick up some of the strays, some of the, you know, budget cards, and especially with 71 Topps because they get beat up so easily. It's so easy to get, you know, a beat up Reggie Jackson or a, you know, a beat up Steve Carlton or, you know, Burt Blyleven card for just pennies on the dollar. So I've got some pages that are just full of star cards and rookie cards that are all beat up. But I wanted to find one that didn't have a lot of the big names on it. So I pulled one page that had one really big name, a couple others that would stand out to longtime baseball fans, but for the most part, common players. And I had Patrick pick out 4 of the 9 cards. And we're going to talk about those 4 players. And he'll be part of that conversation, too. So a whole lot of fun here as we've got a look at the 2020 Topps Heritage, the set that it is based off of, the 1971 Topps set, which is a work of art. And I'll explain why I use that terminology later on. We've got Nick Deonte to talk about the Topps Heritage set, also some of the other items that Topps has coming out, as well as what collectors can do during this nationwide pause as we wait for the whole coronavirus thing to kind of play out. And it's not pleasant as it plays out. But with people stuck inside their homes, you know, trying to entertain not only yourself, but perhaps your kids as well, you've got a lot of free time. So as collectors, what can you do not only to entertain yourself or your kids, but also to kind of take care of one another? So we'll discuss that with Nick. And then, like I said, my son Patrick will join me to talk a little bit about the Heritage cards and the 4 players that he selected at random from that one page of 9 cards. So good to have some fun stuff to talk about. This is where I put my serious hat on, because it doesn't take much to look at the news today and see how grim this whole coronavirus thing is. And I know there's plenty of criticism as to how our nation and our political leaders have botched this. And let's be honest, they have. There's a lot of, you know, commentary about how the nation just was not prepared for an epidemic like this. And this is something that goes back decades through cutting of public funds to healthcare clinics, to you know, county and city health boards, to, you know, the nation's stockpile of things like, you know, face masks and, you know, plastic guards and, of course, ventilators. That's the big thing now with the coronavirus being something that attacks the respiratory system most notably. So, you know, this is something that's been going on and on and on, and it's very easy to see all this and be brought down by it. And what makes it even tougher is that this is something that's going to be going on not for a few days. And I think most people are starting to realize not for a few weeks. This is something that is probably going to take 2 to 3 months just to get a grip on. That's tough for a lot of people to accept. And I'll be the first to say it's tough for me to accept too, because when, you know, the NHL and the NBA and all the sports leagues just shut down, you're thinking, okay, well, maybe by the end of the month or, you know, early mid-April, things kind of shake out. That's not looking to be the case. It looks like the worst of this epidemic is going to be hitting certain cities and certain regions at different times. But over the next, I'd say, 2 to 4 months, or 2 to 4 weeks, excuse me. God, I hope it's not 2 to 4 months, but 2 to 4 weeks, you're probably looking at the worst of this scenario. in terms of, as you know, tests become more available, as data becomes more reliable, in terms of people being diagnosed with it, the people who are having serious complications getting hospitalized, and then what a lot of experts feared, all the hospitals getting overloaded, not enough equipment, not enough frontline staff. You know, the whole healthcare system is going to be taxed throughout this whole thing. So it's going to be very difficult to deal with over the next 2 to 4 weeks in particular. But like I said, this is something that I think is going to take 2 to 3, maybe even 4 months to get a grip on nationwide before it finally, you know, you can quarantine everybody that needs to be quarantined to where you can ease up on social restrictions. And that's tough for a lot of people, first of all, because all the sports have been taken off the board. And sports is the opiate of the masses. I've used that phrase before. It's a riff on Karl Marx. Religion is the opiate of the masses. And especially in North America, sports, we go to sports to get away from all the other crap. You know, we like watching sports and being at sporting events because it takes your mind off of everything else. Well, now that alternative isn't there. Now you're surrounded by everything else. Sports is affected by everything else. And it's very tough for some people to take because your normal outlet, you know, rather than screaming at a politician, you'd rather scream at, you know, a starting pitcher who is not able to find the strike zone or the umpire who is not helping his cause by calling a tight strike zone. You know, you've got all sorts of outlets that, you know, we get upset about silly sports things. Well, now that's not there. So a lot of people are just inundated with the news, and it is very grim news here. So not having that outlet is tough. And I hate to break it to you if you haven't figured it out yet, you're not going to have that outlet for a little while longer. But also, and I've told quite a few people this too, you know, I'm not an expert on history. I know enough to be dangerous. I've read enough about it. I'm interested enough about it. When you look at, especially the United States, for the most part, well over, I'd say, 90% of the existing population, basically from 1946 till now, we have not had to truly sacrifice anything. So I know in recent months there's been a lot of battles between, you know, millennials and Gen X and baby boomers, and everyone's squawking at each other. But honestly, it's basically from the start of the baby boom till now, 5-6 generations of Americans have not had to sacrifice anything. Now, there are some, you know, some exceptions there. If you were drafted to fight in Vietnam, that's different. If you maybe have a medical condition, that's different. You could even argue if you're a minority, that's different. You've had to make sacrifices, not because you wanted to, but society said you had to. Also, you know, on a much more lower level, you know, maybe you turned down a great job offer because your spouse was employed in a good position for your spouse where they could move up in the ladder and you know, be secure in that company. And had you taken this job and moved elsewhere, your spouse wouldn't be able to take their job with them. And, you know, there's sacrifices like that. But again, for the vast majority of people born from 1946 right up until now, have never had to truly make a sacrifice. If you were alive in World War II, you had rationing, you had blackouts. You know, people who weren't supposed to be in the workforce were in the workforce. And that went on for 4 years. Before that, you know, the Great Depression. Why was it a Great Depression? Because it lasted, you know, basically from 1929 up until, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, the war effort became part of the economy, a big part of the economy. So, you know, if you got tied up in the Great Depression, you had to make sacrifices on, you lost your job, you lost your income, you lost your home, you lost your savings. You had to, you know, what did all the farmers in Oklahoma do? They moved out to California. You know, there were all sorts of sacrifices throughout the 1930s. And, you know, even before that, this influenza of 1918, World War I, you can look back, there were certain segments in America's history over the last century or so where big, major personal life concessions were given, sacrifices were made for the greater good of the country, and ultimately, in some cases, like World War I, for the world. So it's hard for a lot of people, basically aged 74 and under, that's most of us, to look at this and, you know, realize how big of a sacrifice it is to basically stay in your home and homeschool your kids and stock up on necessities and only go out if you have to go to a grocery store to pick something up or if you have a doctor's appointment. It's hard for people to accept that. And that's because, again, most of us have never had to make that kind of a sacrifice. So why do I tell you this little history lesson here? It's because while we've never had to make a sacrifice like this up until now, folks, you got to make that sacrifice. That is, if you have a stay-at-home order from your local or state government, stay at home. If you've got social distancing, you've got to be outdoors doing something, you know, stay 6 feet away from each other. If you're not feeling good, for God's sake, stay home, especially if you have a fever. Stay in bed. Nobody's working at this time anyway. So, you know, don't infect other people. Don't scare other people. You've got to stay indoors and help this ride out. The disease has already spread. It continues to spread for people that were not able to or weren't willing to take precautions 2-3 weeks ago. You've got to make that sacrifice, because until you can have more of those masks made, that protective equipment, the ventilators, this is all stuff that's going to take several weeks, if not 2 to 3 months, to make. Until you have all of that, you know the phrase, flatten the curve. And you have to do your part by not just living your normal life, parking at that restaurant, and you know, having that big old Chili's smorgasbord indoors with the risk of infecting other restaurant goers or the staff especially. Yes, it's tough. It's unusual. But you've got to do it, not just for yourself, but for your family, your friends, and for total strangers. I know nowadays it is so hard to accept the notion that, hey, maybe I should do something, you know, just selflessly. Not selfishly, selflessly. I should do something that can benefit someone else. Part of that is stay away. And stay home. We're all adjusting to this. This is completely new. Thankfully, with technology, it is shockingly easy to do a lot of the stuff that we have to do, or at least it's easier than we thought. Some exceptions may be teaching your kids, or if you have a youngster at home, it's, you know, providing daycare for them. But It's going to be a very tough sacrifice. And I know a lot of our listeners are making zero income right now. I'm one of them, okay? I've got a lot of freelance work, a lot of part-time work that was supposed to be ongoing and starting off in the baseball season. It's all on hold, like everything else. So I'm trying not to preach from some high shelf here. I'm just like many of you. You know, we're going to be struggling through this together. So as we wait for, you know, some kind of public assistance, as we wait for things to get back to normal, we're all in this together. We've got to take care of one another. And the most important thing I can say is, with the exception of those, you know, that grocery store trip, that doctor's appointment, if something, God forbid, happens in your family health-wise, you got to go to the emergency room. Unless it's that important, stay inside. Stay home. This is a great time to, first of all, reconnect with your family. I can't tell you how many times, like if I've walked around my neighborhood or if I've made that grocery store visit and I'm, you know, driving through the neighborhood, I've seen so many families walking around, you know, not a bunch of families. I'm just saying like one family unit walking around and kids on bicycles, parents on bicycles. Now, granted, I live in Florida. The weather's a lot warmer here than many of our listening locales. But I've seen so many people reconnect with their family, you know, kind of get away from the rat race. I've seen so many people be nice to one another, which is a pleasant change in this very stressful time. And also while you're doing this, have you ever wanted to, you know, clean that back patio, organize that basement, dust off that desk in your den? Now's the time to do it. Have you ever wanted to read up on all those books or magazines that have been stacking up in a corner of your living room? Now's the time to do it. Have you wanted to binge on any particular TV show? Yep, now's the time to do it. In fact, I'm tempted to binge The Twilight Zone because Twilight Zone is one of my favorite TV shows. And sadly, in the last 3.5 years or so, a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes written by the late, great Rod Serling have proven to be a little too close to reality than I'd like. But I think right now we're in the episode Time Enough at Last. And I won't give away the whole plot. You could probably find the episode on YouTube. But the great Burgess Meredith, playing a banker who finally has some time to read all the books he wants to read. And again, I won't give away the plot device. Chances are you've already seen the episode. But yeah, we are now in a point of time enough at last. And we're just waiting for the fallout to settle. Now, hopefully it's not like nuclear fallout and we're waiting 80 years. But during the next several weeks, more likely 2 to 3 months as this plays out, and as you stay safe and as you stay healthy, you will have time enough at last to take that pause and enjoy some of the things that you kind of push off to the side on a regular basis. Just don't step on your reading glasses like Burgess Meredith did in that episode. So as this podcast continues, as of now, there's no reason for me to change the production schedule. We're still coming your way every Friday, noon Eastern. We'll still post the videos every Thursday or every other Thursday, noon Eastern, basically the day before the podcast comes out. Obviously, like you, you know, our travel is restricted a bit. So I've got a couple of show ideas planned, and we'll probably be doing some purchasing of things off eBay since I can't go to the local card show anymore as that shut down. So, you know, we'll make do. But at least every couple of weeks, we'll make this a nice, positive distraction and hopefully take your mind off of it for a little bit. And if you are opting to spend some of this extra time sorting through your cards and, you know, having a nice, clean collection, making donations, making trades, you're going to see a lot more trades, I think. That's a good thing. If it takes your mind off of all just the morose news that is out there, then I am all for it. So hopefully we can be part of that. And our next show, I'm planning on doing that Santa's Rack Pack, the 1979 Topps Rack Pack, that is not truly a 79 Topps Rack Pack. It is one of the repackaged Rack Packs that has a Merry Christmas little hang tag on it. We'll talk about that and the dangers of investing in stuff like that. Also, I've got some very interesting sporting news cards that were sent to me a few weeks ago from one of our listeners. And we may dive into that in an upcoming show. And like I said, through some eBay purchases, I'll see what's out there. And we'll be opening those items up and talking more about them throughout the next few weeks. And again, hopefully it's all as a positive distraction. Speaking of positive distractions, if you follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, that platform is open for you as well. If you want to talk to other collectors, see what they're doing in the meantime, offer to make up trades, go right ahead. Go ahead and use our platform as just kind of a base for doing that. That is perfectly fine. And of course, you could talk about this podcast, the athletes that we talk about, the cards, the sets that we talk about, or even just some of the topics that come up on the program. I had an interesting email from someone, and you can email me as well. Matt Salmon says, that's MattSamonSez@gmail.com. We were talking about the vending box in our last episode and how it is an efficient way to hand collate a set if you wish, and especially if you're looking to, you know, do junk wax era sets. That's the most available and cheaply available vending boxes that are out there. And I had a listener ask me, why would you go the vending box route when you can go to any card shop or card show or even online and buy a lot of these factory sets for $5 a piece? And I told him, I said, you know, it's a great point that you bring up. And in fact, it's really funny. At the last card show I was at, there was a dealer who had, I believe, an 88 tops, and I want to say 89. I don't think it was 87. But I think it was 88 and 89. Tops factory sets, still wrapped in plastic for like $5 a pop. Or he was selling them like 2 for $12, you know, something like that. Something ridiculously cheap. And I was incredibly tempted to just buy them right there. 88 and 89 tops are two of the sets that I've been hand collating over the last several months. And yeah, it would have been rather easy just to pick them up right there, just stick them in a box in my closet and say, oh, well, I've got a complete factory set of this set and that set. But it kind of takes away the fun. And there is no wrong way to collect. That's one of the best things that I've heard about card collecting. There's no wrong way to collect. You may look at one way as a little different or not as efficient as others, but there is no wrong way to collect. And that is no truer than when it comes to collecting sets. And for me, and this has always been the case ever since I started collecting over 30 years ago, it's the idea of getting several packs or a box of cards, or even buying a lot of cards. You know, you just get that 400 card lot at a garage sale or something, or off eBay. You know, you just drop $20 and get this, you know, box of cards. Going through it, seeing what's there, and trying to pull it all together by yourself, being a builder. And, you know, maybe it's leftover DNA from my dad who was an engineer, I don't know. But I've always found it just more entertaining for me to collect it the old-fashioned way. Let me open the packs. Let me open the boxes. Let me track down those last 8 or 10 cards. Is it cheaper? No, certainly not. In fact, I probably paid twice as much for a vending box than I would have for one of those factory sets. But it's just really fun to open up those packages and check off, you know, scratch the numbers that are on your list and add them into the box and watch the whole thing grow. And I think there's a satisfaction, too, of putting in that last card. And, you know, on the boxes that I put these together in, I'll write, for example, like 1987 Topps Baseball, and I'll put a little box, you know, a little like checkbox, and it says complete. And for me to actually check that box in a big black Sharpie check mark, that is so rewarding to me. It's like, hey, I, you know, pulled this all together. It's cool. Now I can only sell it for $8, but I did it. And, you know, kept me busy and kept me in the hobby and in the sport and talking to my other collector friends. So, you know, for me, it's the thrill of finding, you know, the mystery of opening up these packs and boxes and putting it all together and ultimately checking the box that says, yes, I've done it. And a case in point, 1992 Topps, I'm in the process of hand collating that set. And, you know, I have a factory set. I've mentioned this before. That's the only factory set that I have. I got it as a Christmas gift in the Christmas of 1992. And it's awesome. I love it. I did open the plastic, though, because there were 8 tremendous gold cards I had to open up. But, you know, still, I have a factory set, and it's neat. You know, I've never tried to sell it. I've never tried to move it or give it away. I've always carried it around with me for, what now, 28 years. So that's neat to have it. But I'm still building one on the side just because, to me, it's even neater to kind of pull it all together there. And the guy who emailed me is just, oh, yeah, you know, hey, you know, perfect. And, you know, it's not like we got into some big argument over it. So no matter what you do to pass the time, there is no wrong way to collect. So don't feel bad or you're kind of doing it in a roundabout way. Whatever makes you happy, and especially during the next few weeks, we need happy stuff. We need a lot of happy stuff here in the next few weeks. So whatever makes you happy, that doesn't harm anybody else. And in terms of putting together baseball cards, that should be a relatively easy rule to follow. Go ahead and find that happy way to get things done. And whether it's just buying factory sets by the lot, buying individual packs or boxes of cards or vending boxes or what have you, by all means do it if you can afford to do it. Also, I want to mention real quick before we talk about 71 Topps and bring in Nick Deonte, the normal point of this podcast, I would say, hey, if you would like to make a donation, do so now at paypal.me/waxecstatic, and that invitation is always open. However, I'm going to, at least for the next several weeks, I'm just going to mention it, and that's that. You all have heard the pitch before. You know that donations help not only fund the technical side of this podcast by paying Audioboom to host the podcast, and that it not only keeps the archives free and open for everybody, and that it not only helps me purchase product to discuss on this show, and excess product goes to Common for Kids, but obviously given the economic situation this country is in during this COVID-19 crisis, I'm going to do the soft sell there. So I'll throw the link out there, paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you've got extra cash you wish to donate, great. If not, don't feel bad about it. Keep listening. Keep supporting the podcast. Keep rating and reviewing it if you have that opportunity. And in lieu of any cash donation that you would normally want to make, spreading the word about the podcast is always acceptable. And as I mentioned in our last podcast, too, if you're just eager to unload some cards, and please don't just dump them on my front door. But if you're looking to just move some cards out and you want to ask me, hey, are you interested in these? You know, we could work out a deal, some kind of a trade, or I pick up the shipping cost or something like that. So, you know, we're going to have some exceptions to the rules over the next several weeks. And again, probably 2 to 3 months. So it'll be a soft sell on the PayPal link. Again, if you have the money and you want to contribute, great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If not, it's okay. I completely understand. Like I said, like you, for the most part, I've got $0 coming in to the house right now. I'm not in a dire financial situation, thankfully, with some of the side business that I had started up several months ago. But just like you, a lot of my work plans and budgeting and income got totally screwed up by this whole situation. So we'll all work through this together in one form or fashion. Now, one way to work through this is looking back at some great sets. And I'm going to talk about the 1971 top set here before we bring in Nick Deonte. And I said it at the beginning of the podcast, 1971 tops really is a work of art. Now, the phrase work of art is kind of thrown around a little too easily. Anything that just looks moderately appealing to the eye, people go, oh, that's a work of art. And of course, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's another great Twilight Zone episode, by the way. But he said, pulling it back on track here, but when you look at 71 tops, it is not only a work of art from 1971, it is arguably the best set of the 1970s. It is arguably the best set tops ever put out. And it is arguably one of the best baseball card sets ever produced. And there aren't that many sets that you can say that. Now, the one thing that probably pulls 71 tops back from that ledge of greatness compared to, say, 53 tops or 56 tops, or, you know, you can think of some other sets that are probably up there. It's not totally loaded down with great rookie cards. There are some, let's say, pretty darn good rookie cards. However, the biggest is Burt Blyleven. You've also got George Foster, Steve Garvey, Dusty Baker, Davey Concepcion, Don Baylor, Ken Singleton. So some pretty good all-star and a few Hall of Fame names that are dropped in there. You also have a key second-year card in Thurman Munson. We'll talk a little bit about that card in a bit. And also, you've got some early career cards. So that Tom Seaver, that Steve Carlton, all those players, Johnny Bench, Nolan Ryan, all of those key players from the mid to late 60s. You can even throw in, you know, Pete Rose, even though he had been in the league almost 10 years at that point. But still, you've got a lot of early career cards. Reggie Jackson, another one, that if you can find it in mint condition, then it's worth quite a bit of money. Condition is an issue with 71 tops, though. And that is why a lot of people, even though they will agree with me that the general design concept of 71 tops truly is a work of art, most people will go, it's a headache to to collect. And why? Because of the black borders. This was the first time that Topps put together a black border front design to the card. And it wouldn't be the last time that you would see a black border on a baseball card. Most notably, 85 and 87 Donruss utilized it. Part of the 91 score set had black borders. And it's looking good if you can get those cards in mint condition. But 71 Topps really has trouble staying in mint condition. The only way you can basically get a mint condition 71 Topps card, other than somebody taking meticulous care of it over the last 49 years, is you have to basically pull it from a pack. And that is not too easy. 71 Topps unopened packs are very expensive and little in number, of course. So you really have to look hard for that. And it's not only the black border, but it's also the thicker cardboard stock that was being used in 1971. Topps going to the gray cardboard stock as opposed to the solid white cardboard stock that they had been using in the late 1960s, mid to late 1960s. So, you know, that would become an issue there as well. And then also the fact that it was still 1971. You know, people were not at this point putting cards into top loaders or plastic pages, or once they opened up the pack, they very diligently just kind of stacked them up all nice and neat on a, you know, bedroom table. That's not the case. It was 1971. You were still putting rubber bands around them. You were throwing them into the, shoe box. You were still putting them in your bicycle spokes. So, you know, 71 Topps cards were manhandled quite a bit. And it really wasn't until around the early to mid-70s that you had people coming together and start assigning grades to conditions of cards, basically using the template made by the coin collecting community and the stamp collecting community to set the grading curve on these individual cards. And because of that, a lot of these cards went through a lot of hell over the years, and with a very stringent grading system that kind of became universal in the mid to late 70s, the 71 Topps cards were no longer in mint condition, literally just a few years after they were processed. So that's tough. However, when you look at a 71 Topps card, you will see why this is such a work of art. The black border, as I mentioned, is extremely sharp. At the top, centered of the card, you've got the team name in all capital letters. Then a unique design factor right beneath it. The player's name and the position he played are all in lowercase letters. Even the first letter of the player's first and last name, all lowercase. Very avant-garde, dare I say. Something that was not frequently used in Topps products. However, if you look at 59 Topps, you will see player names in all lowercase once again. You also had more action shots, which was a big change. This wasn't like in, 56 Topps where you had an action shot kind of painted into the background. These are real honest-to-goodness action shots from games that were the picture on the front of the card. And then you have the facsimile autograph as well. Now, before we get to the back of the card, let's talk a little more about the front of the card. When you're looking at the front of this card here, why is it such a work of art? Well, not only because of the unique factors I talked about, the black border, the lettering styles, also the action shots, and just the way, too, that the black border kind of frames the pictures. Even if it isn't an action shot, even if it's a pose shot, it makes for stunning photography in a lot of the cards that are in that set. But also, when you use the context, not only of baseball cards up until that point, but where the United States was in 1971, you pull a much greater appreciation for how trendy this card was. So let's start off with the hobby itself. In 1971, prior to 1971, you had some good card designs, but for the most part, very, very basic. I'm a big fan of a lot of the early 1960s Topps sets. 65 Topps is one of my favorites. And over the years, I've come to like more the 66 through 70. But when you look at 66 through 70, even the quote-unquote burlap sack look of 68 Topps, when you look back at those sets, they're kind of boring. Now, some people will say clean. Some people will say basic. Some people will say efficient. But a lot of people, when you compare those sets to other sets, either earlier in the 60s or later in the 70s, they're kind of boring. 71 Tops totally shakes that up. And especially if you look at it, comparing it to 1970, which is another one of those sets that I've warmed up to over the years. When you look at 71 compared to 70, it is just night and day different. I don't just mean that because the black borders make it kind of nighttime-ish. No. But when you look at that and you see how drastically different of a card the 1971 Topps set is, and you look at even all the previous Topps sets, go all the way back to 1951, while there were some rather unique and truly classic sets made by Topps in that time, nothing was quite like the 71 set. And as time would show us, nothing really has been like the 71 set, which is kind of odd. And it's unfortunate that some of the things Topps was doing in 71, they didn't either ever do again or didn't really utilize until later sets. But I think that's what makes the set even more special, is that it truly is a one-of-a-kind set. And on top of that, when you look at the front of the card and the overall design, you can see 1971 America. And we've had the wild child hippie days of the 1960s winding down just a bit. You've got a changing of the guard here. You've got, like I said, the wild child kind of JFK, LBJ days. Now we're thoroughly right in the middle of the Richard Nixon era. I said era, not error. I'll leave that up to you. But Nixon's in charge. Things are more conservative, or they're trying to be on the home front. You've got all sorts of clashes happening in America. You still have racial divisions. You've got, cross-county school busing people getting at each other's throats. You've got, left-leaning terrorist groups domestically, internationally. You've got hijackings all over the place. So you've got a whole lot going on. And while some people were hoping that the 70s would start out rather nice and progressive, kind of like a launching point of the 60s, hey, we put a man on the moon. Well, by 1971, you're going, this lunar project's just too expensive. We got to cut these man on the moon missions. So, things just drastically changed. The shifting in power from left to right was very sudden and at a breakneck speed. And it was a very weird time in 1971. And I think it's best encapsulated in the legendary Who song, Won't Get Fooled Again. It meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Parting on the left is now parting on the right. There was a whole lot of changes going on in the 70 to 71 time, and especially in the United States. So when you have kind of the calamity of the 60s going into the uncertainty, I don't want to say conservatism, but the uncertainty as things tried to go down the middle of the road in the early 70s, to see something as stark as the 71 Topps set, I honestly could see, like, if you blew up some of these cards into, say, 24-inch by 36-inch, whatever the correct ratio would be for a baseball card, but you get my drift, basically poster size. If you put it on canvas, you could put some of these up in the local art museum or, the Metro Art Museum in New York or the Louvre. You really could. You really could. I totally believe that. Let's flip the card over to the back, shall we? Something that is existential and truly connecting us to 1971. Avocado green. I've joked about the green backs of cards. You saw them a lot with Topps products in the 1970s. Really started with 1967 Topps. It was a color of the decade. It was a color of the times. If you're old enough to remember, you had something that was that exact same color. It was maybe your car, more likely your shag carpet in your living room, very possibly the dishwasher and refrigerator unit that your parents bought at Sears, and maybe it still works today. My mom still has a freezer that my parents bought at Sears like 45 years ago. It's still humming along. It's amazing. And it outlasted Sears, now that I think of it. But, you know, everybody had something that was avocado green in the early 70s. So it is just perfect for the time. But also what was unique, and again, what makes the backs of the cards just really stand out, is you've got a full headshot photo of the player on the back. Now, it's a black and white photo on the olive green or avocado green background with the gray cardstock. It comes in a little too dark at times. But you have this very unique thing that Topps never did before, putting a player's picture on the back of of the card, I should say. And then you've got, on top of that, you've got limited stats because of all the space that's taken up by the picture and by the narrative. You only have enough room for last year's stats and then the previous or the career stats, I should say, or it says on the back of the card, life. And you've got a little nod to when the player made his pro debut, so minor league debut, if you will, and when he made his major league debut. But that was about it. So when it comes to information, it's definitely limited on the backs of the cards, but the overall design, something completely new and different from Topps, it is definitely standing out in that set. Now, the 71 Topps set also had something different in terms of the size. At the time, it was the largest set that Topps made at 752 cards. That was part of the expansion of 1969. Instead of just having a whole group of players that were drafted by or from other teams, now you had the class of 69 started having their own prospects and their own regulars. So Topps had to, with the four teams that came in 1969, had to expand the overall set just a little bit while still featuring some favorite cards. I wouldn't call them inserts because they're part of the base set, but favorite cards such as league leaders, also a recap of the 1970 World Series. And, you know, the usual stuff that you saw in sets from the late 1960s. Not too many variations, or at least nothing that really stands out in the set. The short print cards are most notably in series 6 and 7. As we've discussed before, Topps would short print those later series because stores didn't want to buy later series when they still had, say, series 3 or 4 on the shelf. And of course, a lot of people's attention shifting to football come July or August when those later series would come out. And of course, would eventually lead to Topps making the One Series release starting in 1974. Now, something about the 71 Topps set that is unique are some old classics as well. You've got the scratch-off cards that are in packs and also large metal coins. Those are fun collectibles as well. If you can't get the cards in great condition, perhaps you can find the coins in good enough condition. And of course, the coins, because they were inserts on packs, featured the top players in the major leagues at that time. So you can get some pretty big names for, in most cases, not a whole lot of money if you're looking around for some of those coins from the 71 Topps set. So how does the 71 Topps set compare to what Topps is putting out now with the 2020 edition of Topps Heritage? Well, for more about that, as well as what you can do in your additional free time that you're finding yourself having these days, I'm very pleased to bring in our first special guest, a contributor to Forbes magazine, and also a big fan of our show, and we're a big fan of his as well. And he is hunkered down in the heart of New York City, like a lot of people are right now. Nick Deonte. Nick, thank you so much for joining us on Wax Ecstatic this week.
I look forward, once the calendar turned to 2020, to coming on again to talk about Topps Heritage.
Well, it's definitely something that a lot of people are picking up, not just because it's a great product, but somebody needs something to do indoors, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. I do want to, if you listeners didn't listen to the episode we did last year when we were looking at Topps Heritage and the 1970 Topps set, Nick also has a very interesting side job, which, much like everything else right now, is kind of on the back burner with offices and production lines shut down everywhere. But Nick gets to sample and rate and review
products from the Topps Baseball Card Company. So it's really a sweet gig here. Not everybody can do it. Fortunately for Nick, he was able to get in line at the right place in the right time, and he gets products from Topps to look at and share with other people and to be an influencer with. So that's why we talked to Nick about these particular items. And Nick, let's dive right into the Topps Heritage Set. Now, I've only had a chance to buy just a couple of packs, to be honest with everybody. And that's not only because of, you know, the COVID-19 thing and trying to stay indoors like most everybody else, but you know, it's just everything's come so fast this spring here, so I have a small sample size. But I gotta tell you that the quality of the product is great, the design is great, some of the interesting little bonus tchotchkes that Topps has been able to work into the Heritage releases over the last few years are pretty cool as well. What are your thoughts about that set? And, you know, some of the neat things that collectors can get if they're standing in a long checkout line at their nearby supermarket and there just happens to be a box of these Heritage packs sitting, looking at them, begging them to be bought off the shelf.
Well, first, I would say pick up a box. I always think it's worth taking a dive into Topps Heritage just to see how the new players look in the old designs. And with this year's set, I think the 1971 Topps design is so classic with those black borders, and it frames the pictures, you know, just right on the cards, and I think it's a really great set to look at from a visual standpoint. So I think collectors are going to enjoy that. And then you mentioned the variations, and I think that's what's going to keep all of us sharp when looking at this set. Are the variations, because it forces you to spend time with the cards. Now that we're all inside, right, and we have a little more time on our hands, we can turn those cards over, check out the little nuances, read those tiny codes, look at the stats, and see what we have in each box.
You know, you mentioned the tiny codes. That just goes to show how much worse my eyesight has gotten over in the last few years, because it used to be so much easier to try to read the codes and see what was a variation and what wasn't. I think another thing that's interesting, Nick, is as the Heritage, and you know, the Heritage brand's been around for 20 years now, but as the Heritage line has grown, in particular over the last few years, Topps is, I've noticed, and somewhat subtly, and then it gets out and they kind of take credit for it, but it's not just the design. Sometimes it's the pictures, and we're starting to see some mirror images of the new cards to old ones. And the best one that I could find was the Gary Sanchez card. It's an action photo of Gary tagging somebody out at home plate. And it's a horizontal shot as opposed to a vertical shot. What legendary 71 Topps card does this remind you of?
You know, there's a certain captain for the Yankees.
Yes.
That this reminds you of it. Actually, I didn't see the Sanchez card, but once you start to make the reference, you know, if a man is very special here in New York, I'm sure that car looks very close to what was on the Thurman Munson card.
Absolutely, and that's the first thing I thought of as I'm just flipping through this pack and I get the Sanchez card, and it's an action shot and it's horizontal, and I'm like, well, I think I've seen this before. And sure enough, I even looked up a picture of the Thurman Munson 71 Topps card. And yeah, it's not an exact replica, but it's, you know, it's a very neat, similar kind of tip of the cap there to not only a legendary card, but a legendary player who, you know, passed well before his time. Of course, a lot of people on the 40th anniversary of Munson's death last August, remembering him well. So I thought that was kind of neat for Topps to do. And like I said, I've only had a small sample size, so I don't know if there are any other cards that kind of do a throwback to some of the photos from 1971. But speaking of photos, I thought it was interesting how in 71, Topps included a headshot of a player on the back of the card. This was a first, and it was for every player. Yet, strangely, Topps didn't do that again until 1993. In fact, they showcased pictures of stadiums in 1992 before they showcased pictures of players on the backs of cards of 1993. But looking back at the 71 Topps set, Nick, are there any other, you mentioned the black borders, are there any other neat little things about the 71 set that you recall that collectors who may not have really paid much attention to 71. Maybe they pick up on some of those nuances in the Heritage set this year.
I like the triple rookies. I thought those were really cool to look at. I'm looking at, like, Dusty Baker's rookie card here with Don Baylor and Tom Pachorik. You know, a few of the teams have those rookie outfielders. And actually, if you look at the 2020 set, Topps went out of their way to put Jordan Alvarez and Aristides Aquino on the same card, as opposed to keeping them with their teammates. So I think that's, like, a cool nuance in this year's set, and I pointed that out in my article for Forbes.
And as we mentioned in a podcast a few weeks ago, the Andrew Ridgeleys of rookie cards, where you have a star and then you have somebody that people long forget about. That's one of the neat things about some of the older Topps sets is sometimes they lumped the players together by team, or sometimes it was lumped together by position. So again, a nice little tip to, you know, how things once were by Topps here in the Heritage set. Nick Deontay, a contributor to Forbes here and also a product influencer, there's another thing to put on your resume, with Topps, joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. Now, Nick, before we talk about some of the other cards that'll be coming down the product line soon, let's talk about the base set, Topps Series 1. Again, I've had a small sample series this small sample size, I should say, of the series. But in the handful of packs that I've bought, really like the design. Topps is not drastically trying to, you know, rebuild the wheel here, but they are changing just enough things from a design perspective to make it just slightly different than the year before, but still overall a great product. And I also noticed it seems like they're inserting a couple more cards in every pack here. So if you complain about having to spend $3 on a pack, at least you're getting a little more bang for your buck here. But what are your thoughts about at least Series 1 of the 2020 Topps base set?
I thought for what it needed to do, it delivered. It's a nice, clean design. You had the right rookies in there. Everyone was waiting to get Alvarez rookie card, so I think that was a major selling point. And they also had some interesting variations, and they made sure that, like, some of the key rookies also had variations so that, like, people would be going after the product. So I thought that was well done on Topps' end. And they also had a cool, like, decades insert set that went over, like, either the best players or some of the best teams of each decade.
Now, Nick, one thing that the COVID-19 virus is doing is, of course, shutting down businesses everywhere, and that includes Topps and Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball. Everyone's on standstill as we all wait for this to play out over the next few weeks. Have you heard anything from Topps, or have you seen anything from them about some of the products that are coming up? Obviously, products that are tied to certain dates in the baseball calendar, there's a big question mark. But have you heard anything new from them on some of the other releases that we would be anticipating over the next few months?
I haven't received any guidance yet on Topps because, right, their corporate offices are in New York, but I think they also have production in Pennsylvania. And so I'm still seeing product come, but I haven't got anything officially yet from Topps that products are going to be delayed because, you know, I think they have to produce a certain amount of product every year to the agreement they have with Major League Baseball and the amount of money that they have invested to continue to put out the product. But I am seeing some dealers are in a quandary because if their shops are closed, how are they going to sell the product if they don't have a strong online presence?
Yeah, and the online presence is going to be big here because it's not just dealers with shops, but everyone's favorite weekend distraction, the card show. If you live in an area that still has a card show or two on a regular basis,
those are going to be off limits for quite a while.
Yeah, they're going to be on hold for a very long time just because you don't want too many people congregating together there. So with that in mind, Nick, let's kind of swing the conversation to what collectors can do. You know, most businesses have some kind of online presence, or they're ramping it up quite a bit here. But as we've mentioned, with most people spending more time indoors and trying to kill some time and you know, make something of the downtime, What are you hearing from other collectors? What are they doing to stay busy? What have you done to, pass away the time here? Like you said, you can get into the details of some of the newer cards, but have you heard the community bring up some suggestions that we all could take since a lot of us are in lockdown over the next few weeks?
Sure. So I think breakers are still going to be in effect to the extent that they can operate. So I think a lot of people are either going to live vicariously through the breakers or participate in the breaks because they can't go out. So I think they may have some leverage. If I can give a plug here, if you want to check our YouTube account, it's Examine Baseball. And you can see some of the breaks that we've done over the years. And also, I think it's just time for everyone to reconnect with their collections. There's always organizing to be done, sorting to be done. Are there some cards that no longer speak to you the same way? Although I think it's going to be hard to move them. But I think trading might come back pretty big. And that's what I enjoy about like the Twitter community. I think there's a lot of collectors on Twitter that are willing to trade it this time because, you know, it keeps things moving and it keeps things fresh. So I think you're going to see a lot more trading online because people are going to be spending more time with their collections and figuring out what they want to do with all the cards they've accumulated.
And of course, with any trading, that's the old barter system. And as people, a lot of people seeing paychecks either cut or, eliminated, unfortunately, during this time, as businesses try to figure out what to do, nothing wrong with a trade. If you can find something that is of equal value to send to somebody else, the only thing it costs you is whatever the postage is. And if it's just a handful of cards, it's a couple bucks and not much more if you're sending out a bigger shipment. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm a big, big proponent in trades. And that is something that I think will crop up here during this time. And, man, all that time that I spent organizing my cards in the previous months, I could have been doing now. I guess I was just ahead of the curve there. But a nice, orderly group of cards and card boxes always not only makes your collection look good, but I'm a big champion of groups like Commons for Kids. If you're looking for a place to move these cards, they, of course, will always take donations. And there are other groups out there, so you can look around a little bit.
Signatures for Soldiers.
Yes.
My friend Tim, I think he's always willing to take donations as well. And he's got a great cause with Military Missions in Action, so they do some great work. So I think that's also a place where people can send stuff as well.
Yeah, and I always like to caution, while these groups, such as Signatures for Soldiers or Commons for Kids or you name it, while they're always appreciative of any donation, don't just dump all of your 88 Donruss on them.
Right.
You know, do add some new cards there, some star cards as well, and in some cases some non-sports too, just to mix things up just a little bit. Well, Nick, we again appreciate your time. I know, especially since you're based in New York City, it's interesting times up there. It's interesting times for everybody around the world. And for collectors, at least we've got some product out there to not only look at and marvel at, but to just keep ourselves busy. So Nick Diente, contributor to Forbes, and a man of many talents, joining us here on Wax Ecstatic once again to look at some of the new Topps products, specifically Topps Heritage and the mirroring of the 71 Topps set. Thanks again, Nick. Stay safe. Stay at home as well, and hopefully we'll all emerge from this in good shape in a few weeks.
Matt, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be on.
All right. Thanks again to Nick Diente, who is a contributor to Forbes magazine. Also, one of the many educators learning how to teach distance education, which is not that easy when you're a physical education teacher. But he is also very active on Twitter, part of baseballhappenings.net. And you can follow him on Twitter at Examine Baseball. That's one word as it sounds, Examine Baseball. Always appreciative of Nick taking the time to join us. And it's going to become an annual tradition, given that, we finally realized after not doing this for a few years that looking at the new Topps Heritage material and comparing it to the original set it was based off of is not a real bad idea. So we like to have Nick come in to look back at those sets now based on early 70s Topps sets and let you know about some of the new Topps products that are coming out.
Now, you know it's a big show when I say we've got one special guest. Well, how about two? If you watch the video link from yesterday, looking at the Heritage cards and the original 1971 top set, you saw my son Patrick, or at least his hand. You heard him, too. So we're going to bring Patrick into the program here. Say hello, bud.
Hello.
All right. So there's Patrick. This is his first professional podcast. I'm being rather coy calling it professional. But, Patrick, we're going to talk a little bit about the Heritage cards, because they're new. Mm-hmm. The 71 Topps cards, because it wasn't the first time you've seen them. You've seen some of the cards I've picked up at card shows.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about some of the players that you selected, some very interesting and, in some cases, tough stories to share. So let's start off real quickly. What did you think of the Heritage cards? We've bought a couple of packs here. What do you like about them?
Well, I think they're, like, they did a good job of designing them to look like they're the ones back in 1970s.
Okay. And you already took one of my cards, G-Man Choi, so mm-hmm. that's adding to your Rays collection. And I'll be snagging one of yours from the next pack we buy. So you like how they look like they did in 1971. Mm-hmm. So what do you like about the 1971 cards?
Well, for one thing, I like how they loved green back then.
Avocado green, as we like to call it, yes. And anything else?
Well, it just looks like something that would be back in the 1970s.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. It's got a lot of design elements that take it back there. All right, so let's talk about some of the players here. You selected from that one page of cards, Dean Chance, mm-hmm. Blue Moon Odom, Danny Walton, and Dan McGinn. So of those four, which one do you want to talk about first?
Dan McGinn.
Dan McGinn. All right. Dangerous Dan McGinn, who is featured on this 1971 Topps card. In fact, there's a picture of it right there as I'm looking at it. With the Montreal Expos, a Southpaw picture, and getting a lot of this information from Norm King's article at Society for American Baseball Research. Surprisingly, of the four players you selected, two, there wasn't a whole lot of information, so I had to do some digging, and one of them was Dangerous Dan McGinn, who was born in Omaha, Nebraska, the eldest of three children, and no surprise here, he was a star baseball player when he was very young, but as often is the case with athletes, especially in the 1940s and 50s when he was growing up, he was a star in baseball, football, and basketball, and he also went into football mainly as he was a star for the high school team. In 1962, led the North squad of the Nebraska High School Shrine Game to a 28-0 victory, and he also won the Outstanding Player Award. Now, that helped people scout him better and get to know him a little better, and he was going to sign, or he had already signed a letter of intent to play for Nebraska, but he was sniped away by Notre Dame. So, yes, Dan McGinn was going to be a quarterback at Notre Dame. The problem is that Dan McGinn was a very, very devoted backup quarterback for Notre Dame, as John Huarte, the Heisman Trophy winner in 1964, was the starter. So he wasn't able to break in on the Notre Dame squad as the quarterback. However, he was able to play several different positions, including split end, running back, defensive back, and punter. And in fact, he actually spent most of his time as a punter at Notre Dame, and that's where he picked up his nickname of Dangerous Dan McGinn. Now, after playing at his time in Notre Dame and not being able to really catch on in football, even though he was quite ubiquitous, he would later go on to play with the Notre Dame baseball team as a starting pitcher. And while he had a lot of velocity, his control was not that good, which is not really a surprise. Still, coming out of Notre Dame, he was drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals in the 21st round of the amateur draft in 1965. Now, he didn't sign with them, actually played Illinois Collegiate League baseball in the summer of 1965, and was later drafted by the Cincinnati Reds in 1966. Now, as he's working his way up through the Reds farm system, he kind of gets stuck in Knoxville. It was the AA franchise at the time, and the manager of the AA Reds team in Knoxville was Sparky Anderson, who of course would be the manager of the Cincinnati Reds, the big red machine days, and later the Detroit Tigers in the 1980s. And it was Sparky who convinced Dan McGinn to go from the starting rotation to the bullpen, because the Cincinnati Reds didn't have a lot of left-handed relievers. They have plenty of left-handed starters, but not enough left-handed relievers. So he switched to becoming a reliever, and that fast-tracked him up into the major leagues actually rather quickly. In fact, in 1968, he makes his major league debut. And you're going to love this story, Patrick. So he gets called up on September 3rd, and that night he's going to Cincinnati. In fact, he was coming in from, I believe, Asheville. And so he comes... I said Knoxville. He was actually in Asheville. That's where Sparky Anderson was his manager. So he's flying in from Asheville, North Carolina, shows up at Cincinnati. This is when they're playing in the old Crosley Field. And he has no idea how to get to Crosley Field. He finally gets to Crosley Field during the game. And of course, this is a major league call-up. He has no idea what Crosley Field looks like. He doesn't know where the clubhouse is. He doesn't know where anything is. So he finally finds his way into the clubhouse, gets a uniform on. He's told, go to the bullpen. And he's like, well, where's the bullpen? And in one, Crosley Field was opened in like 1909 or 1912, something like that. So the bullpen is in one of those nooks and crannies in these old stadiums. So he shows up. And as he is in the bullpen, they get called to warm up. So he and teammate Ted Abernathy, they start warming up in the bullpen. He gets called to the dugout, and the Reds manager at the time, Dave Bristol, says, go pinch run. So the major league pitcher now in his first major league game has to run out onto the base paths as a pinch runner. So there's a pop-up. He's done. That's the third out of the inning. So he's running back to the dugout, and that is when Bristol says, get back out there. You're on the mound. So all of a sudden, Dangerous Dan McGinn is now pitching in his major league debut. And it doesn't necessarily go well, although he certainly learned along the way how to make adjustments. In fact, another funny story here, in a game against the Pittsburgh Pirates, he's called in with two on, one out, and the Hall of Famer Willie Stargell coming up. That's when Johnny Bench, the catcher, comes to the mound, smiles, and simply says, you're in trouble, pal, and walks back behind the plate. Fortunately for Dan McGinn, he got out of trouble by striking out Stargell and then the next batter, who was Don Clendenin. So after 1968, as you've got the 1969 expansion coming up, the Reds, even though they saw promise in McGinn, decided to leave him unprotected for the amateur draft, and that is when the Montreal Expos signed him as their 14th pick, or selected him, I should say. Now, he had a rather unique start to the 1969 season. In fact, he is still in the record book for several things that happened that season. First of all, Dan McGinn has on the record books, he is the first winner of a game in Montreal Expos history. He came in for Jim Mudcat Grant, who was the starter in their first ever game against the Mets at Shea Stadium. So the Expos take the lead while McGinn is pitching, and he gets the first win in Expos history. He would also pick up the first win in Canada as a major leaguer a little later on, as the Expos held on to a win over the St. Louis Cardinals. But what is also interesting is Dan McGinn, in this first game back in 1969, so this is the same game that he would ultimately win, he became the first Expo player to hit a home run. And he hit it all. Yeah, well, he was a pitcher, National League, so you still have pitchers hitting a home run. It was his only career home run in the big leagues, and it was only against some guy named Tom Seaver. So if you're going to hit your only home run in Major League history, it might as well be against a Hall of Famer in your team's first game, in which you get credit for the first win. So while Dan McGinn had quite the incredible debut in the big leagues, his career unfortunately didn't fare as well. He had a decent 1970 season, but started dealing with injuries in 1971, was spending more time in their minor league organization. first with Winnipeg, and then eventually the Expos decided to move him to the Chicago Cubs in exchange for Hector Torres and first baseman Hal Breeden. Now, McGinn wasn't too upset because he was still living in South Bend, Indiana, Chicago not that far away, and he also had the chance to play for Leo Durocher, who, in McGinn's words, was really more of just the face of the club, and he wasn't actually doing any managing. And that was the problem with Leo the Lip later on in his career. Now, after his big league career ended following the 1973 season, when he was in Wichita, which was the Cubs' AAA farm club, he then returned to Omaha and spent 24 years working for AT&T in sales and marketing, eventually becoming a national account manager, and he would later scout for the Phillies and became the pitching coach at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, starting in the year 2000. Also, his kids got involved in baseball. No surprise there. Both his and his wife, Rhea, their sons, Sean and Mark, played minor league ball. Sean, part of the Phillies minor league system as a shortstop, and he would later move on to a scouting position with the Royals and Twins. Mark, a pitcher drafted by the Mets, and after his baseball career ended, he became a home builder in the Omaha area. So even though Dan McGinn is probably the least known of those four cards that you selected, some pretty interesting stories there. All right, Patrick, we've got, Danny Walton, Blue Moon Odom, or Dean Chance. Who's next?
Blue Moon Odom.
Blue Moon Odom. There you go. Johnny Blue Moon Odom of Macon, Georgia. Where did Johnny Blue Moon Odom get that awesome nickname? Well, from a neighborhood childhood friend, of course, who wasn't being very friendly and said that Johnny Odom's head was so big it looked like the moon, and then it eventually turned into Blue Moon. And at first, Odom didn't really like that nickname, but eventually he came to love it over the years. Now, Johnny Odom was also a high school star in baseball, basketball, football, and track. He was one of the best high school pitchers in Georgia, believe it or not. Blue Moon Odom had the opportunity to pick between either a sports career or a music career, as Otis Redding and Little Richard came out of the same high school that Blue Moon Odom went to, but his voice changed and he wasn't as good of a singer anymore when he got a little older. So he went the sports route and, like I said, became one of the best pitchers in Georgia, compiling a 42-2 record, including 8 no-hitters during his time. And that obviously caught the attention of many Major League scouts, including the Kansas City Athletics. Charles Finley, the owner of the Athletics, was so sold on bringing Odom into the organization, signing him as a free agent, that he arranged for a truck to deliver food to the Odom family home. He met and charmed his mother, Florine, at one point going into her kitchen to help cook. That, and also the chance that Odom could deal directly with the team owner as opposed to a general manager or a scout, helped Odom sign with the Athletics. A $75,000 bonus. This was back in 1962, I believe, 1964. That bonus then the largest given to a black athlete. Now, he would have to go through the tough times, to say the very least, of living and playing in the segregated South when he was assigned to the Birmingham Barons. That was then the AA team for the Kansas City Athletics. Now, what's interesting about Blue Moon Odom is he goes through, living and playing in the segregated South. Like I said, he grew up there in Macon, Georgia, but traveling around and seeing how different things were and really being in the heart of racial tension, which was Birmingham, Alabama in the mid-60s, he got a firsthand account of this while playing in Birmingham. He was pulled over by a local policeman, and after the policeman realized who he was, decided to let him go without giving him a ticket for this rather flimsy traffic violation. However, the police officer gave him a warning. This is Birmingham, Alabama. It's real important you stay in the black part of town. Now, I substituted black for the word that was actually used, but that was life in the South in the mid-1960s. Now, as he's dealing with all of these societal issues, he's actually doing extremely well in Birmingham and quickly moves up the ladder. In fact, makes his debut in Kansas City not too long down the line. In fact, September 5th, 1964, against The New York Yankees. The debut did not go too well for Odom. However, his next game was against the Baltimore Orioles, and he was able to shut out the Orioles, an 8-0 win.
So surprised, too.
Yeah, well, no, the Orioles back then were pretty good. You had Boog Powell, you had Brooks Robinson. The Orioles the next year would actually win the World Series. So while he was a little nervous against the Yankees, he was able to get the Orioles in a 2-hit shutout for his first major league victory. Now, as the Athletics moved to Oakland, Odom did as well, and he became one of the first stars of the Oakland Athletics, becoming a star part of their rotation in 1968. And as the Athletics were starting to build into a solid contender in the late 60s and early 70s, it was Odom who led the way, as other players such as Jim Catfish Hunter and also Vida Blue would come in. And, of course, we know about the offense, notably Reggie Jackson and several other players, Joe Rudy, Gene Tennis, Sal Bando, you name it. So the A's eventually become a regular contender, winning 101 games in 1971, and they would go on into the playoffs. They would lose to the Orioles in the ALCS, but in 1972 started that string of consecutive World Series victories, winning the World Series 3 times. Now, even though the A's were a contending team, there were a lot of contention within the Oakland Athletics locker room at that time. In fact, Odom, who was already a pretty outsized personality, was clashing with another personality in Vida Blue, physically clashing as there were fist fights that occurred even during the 1972 playoffs. As the A's are marching on to their first of three consecutive World Series, there was a lot of infighting happening in that clubhouse. So they win the World Series again in 1973 against the Mets, 74 against the Dodgers. But then Charlie Finley starts breaking up the Oakland Athletics, mostly trying to get ahead of the new dawn of free agency in Major League Baseball. So Blue Moon Odom, not Vida Blue, Blue Moon Odom would be one of the first big stars who was moved in 1975 as Finley started dismantling the team. He was sent to the New York Yankees as a free agent. He was one of the first free agents kind of declared on a technicality, and he did not get off to a good start with the Yankees, and eventually was traded to the Indians for Dick Bosman and Jim Perry. So he spends just a little time in Cleveland, then gets sent to the Atlanta Braves, which was basically just getting sent to purgatory in 1975, as the Braves were just an absolutely terrible team back then. Now, he was starting the 1976 season in the minor leagues with Richmond, which was the Braves' AAA club. He is then traded to the Chicago White Sox in June of 1976. Now, remember, the White Sox were owned once again by Bill Veeck. He couldn't compete with the new free agency market, so he would often trade for players who were in the final year of their contract, try to get a team that was good enough to gather a crowd at Old Comiskey Park, and then a lot of those players he would either trade later or just let their contracts expire and they would sign elsewhere as free agents. So Blue Moon Odom was one of those guys, just on a minor league deal, gets picked up by the White Sox, ironically against the Oakland Athletics on July 28th in Oakland. You had Blue Moon Odom, as well as teammate Francisco Berrios, teaming up for a combined no-hitter. So a little bit of revenge there for Blue Moon Odom. Meanwhile, that would pretty much be the highlight of his waning years, as the White Sox sparingly used him down the stretch in 1976. He latched on with the A's once again in 1977 with a minor league deal. Couldn't really stay in Oakland, even though they were going through a rebuilding process. He would later play in the Mexican League for a couple of seasons. Now, after his professional career came to an end, a whole lot of trouble for Blue Moon Odom, even though it appeared he was just living the normal life. He was working with Xerox in Southern California as a computer maintenance operator. But then one day he was arrested for selling cocaine to a coworker. To make matters worse, during the time of the trial, police were called in, as well as the SWAT team, as he was holding his wife hostage in a prolonged battle with the police. Thankfully, no shots fired, nothing bad happening besides that, but he did have to serve 55 days in jail. The good news,
that's
though,
it?
Well, that's a lot. That's 55 more than you ever really want to spend behind bars. But it turned out to be life-changing for Odom, thankfully, as the whole incident in that time period in 1985, first the drug arrest and then the hostage situation, got him cleaned up and sober and a much friendlier person by all accounts. Thanks to Greg Arion of the Society for American Baseball Research for a lot of those details. All right, Patrick, two more players here. Dean Chance or Danny Walton?
Danny Walton.
Danny Walton. Have you ever heard me say there are some baseball players who you would call 4A players?
Mm-hmm.
So do you recall what a 4A player is?
Mm-mm,
no? Probably. All right. So you have the minor leagues. You have single A, double A, triple A,
yes.
And then you have Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Being a 4A player, it's actually not a compliment. Being a 4A player means you're really good at triple A, but you're not good enough for the major leagues. You kind of fall into this nether region of being a great minor leaguer and a major leaguer. And that is what the late Danny Walton was, unfortunately, as he was a star growing up, like a lot of people at the time, thinking that he was going to be the next Mickey Mantle. It's always bad when you start comparing people to great stars like that. But Danny Walton was an outstanding hitter in the mid-1960s, and he was drafted by the Houston Astros, and he's moving up through the Astros organization. And while he is starring in the Astros minor leagues, he just can't cut it in the major leagues. In fact, you could call him kind of a white Pedro Serrano, as he was a guy who could nail a home run 400 feet to left field if it was a fastball. But if you gave him any kind of breaking ball, especially a curveball, he couldn't hit it. Case in point, 1967, playing for the Carolina League, 25 home runs, slugging percentage 533.
Wow.
In the Texas League, 1968, again, striking out a lot, but when he connected, going deep a lot. Got a cup of coffee in Houston, 1968. Astros still weren't sold on him, thought he needed a little more seasoning in 1969. So he goes back to AAA. And while he is standing out with Oklahoma City, the Astros decide to trade him to the Seattle Pilots. Now, this despite the fact that Danny Walton was the Sporting News Minor League Player of the Year. Case in point, he could not be a great major leaguer. He was that 4A type player. So yeah, he and a teammate, outfielder Sandy Valdespino, traded to the Pilots for veteran first baseman and outfielder Tommy Davis. So Danny Walton, while you go, oh no, because the Seattle Pilots were so bad, well, with an expansion team, you get the opportunity to play. So Walton would play, and even though he only averaged a 217 batting average throughout the season, he showed a little bit of power and was good enough defensively to where the Pilots were penciling him in to be a starting outfielder in 1970. Well, he would be, although not with the Seattle Pilots. Of course, they moved to Milwaukee, became the Brewers right at the beginning of the 1970 season. And while he got off to a great start on the field, in fact, he hit .325 in the month of April, he also got a great start with the fans. There was a big fan club in left field called Walton Country who just cheered him. There wasn't a whole lot to cheer about the 1970 Milwaukee Brewers, but the fans loved Danny Walton, and he was returning that love by signing autographs and getting one-on-one with the fans. He was very, very popular, and he was also popular in the clubhouse. His teammates liked him, but again, that whole 4A thing started coming back. His batting average went way down as the 1970 season continued. He had to deal with knee surgery in 1971, couldn't quite get back to the level of play that he was used to, and again, couldn't hit a curveball to save his life. On June 7th, 1971, the Brewers trade Walton to the Yankees for two minor leaguers, Frank Tepedino and Bobby Mitchell. The Yankees, who were witnesses to a home run given up to Danny Walton in 1970, thought that he would provide some power, but again, he couldn't consistently do it. And this starts the string of Danny Walton playing major league, minor league, and bouncing around from team to team. In November of 1972, he's traded to the Minnesota Twins for a young catcher named Rick Dempsey, who would have a pretty solid career. Starting in 1973 with the Twins, not only was Danny Walton going back and forth between major leagues and minor leagues and from one team to another, but now he was getting stuck in a backlog of outfielders. That was no different with the Twins, who already had Bobby Darwin, Larry Heisel, Jim Holt, the veteran designated hitter Tony Oliva, who was still hitting over 300 on average at that time. So Walton was getting lost in the shuffle and spending more time in the minor leagues. But again, doing extremely well in the minor leagues, learning how to switch hit too, but he just couldn't crack the Twins roster consistently or the lineup consistently. Eventually, the Twins trade him to the LA Dodgers, but again, the Dodgers already have plenty of outfielders, Dusty Baker, Reggie Smith, Bill Buckner, also veterans in Lee Lacy and Manny Mota. So Walton is spending most of his time in AAA with the Albuquerque Dukes. Eventually in 1977, In 1977, he is dealt to the Astros for minor leaguer Alex Taveras. The Astros give him a little bit of a look-see late in the season, but they're not sold on him. So Danny Walton finally goes to Japan, where surprisingly, he continued to struggle, especially trying to hit breaking pitches. Ironically, he goes back to Seattle, signing a minor league deal with the New Mariners in 1979. Can't really get any time in Seattle. In fact, he never played a game for the Mariners. Eventually signs with the Rangers, gets a little bit of a look-see at the end of the 1980 season, but doesn't last there either. What's interesting, over his professional career, he played over 16 seasons in major league or professional ball, I should say, including that time in Japan. And while he had that one great season with Milwaukee in 1970, just was not able to consistently be a major league star. He was, however, a minor league star, and to this day, a lot of fans, old-time minor league baseball fans, will remember him for some of the things that he did as a minor leaguer. Unfortunately, he passed away back in 2017, but even though he didn't make it in the majors, he did rather well, like I said, as a career minor leaguer or a 4A player. All right, Patrick, are you ready for Dean Chance?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dean Chance.
Yeah, before, yeah. He had a pretty interesting life.
Yeah, well, how did Dean Chance have an interesting life?
No, the last player.
Oh, Danny Walton, yeah. Danny Walton had a very interesting life. Never gave up, which is, you know, the moral of the story there. And still, he's a major league ball player and still loved in Milwaukee even 50 years later. Now, Dean Chance definitely had a very interesting life. Wilmer Dean Chance, as he was known, a powerful and crafty left-handed pitcher who was one of the early stars of the Los Angeles / California Angels. He became, at the time in 1964, the youngest pitcher to win the Cy Young Award when he was with the Angels. He had 20 wins that year and a 1.65 earned run average. Now, back then, the Cy Young Award, there was only one given out, not like today where you have a Cy Young Award winner in the National League and the American League. How did Dean Chance end up in Los Angeles? Well, he grew up in Ohio, and he was a basketball and baseball star. In fact, led the basketball team to a 1958 state title. That's West Salem's Northwestern High School in Ohio. And you thought Blue Moon Odom had a pretty impressive high school record in baseball. Patrick, listen to this. During his high school years, Chance set several state records which still stand, including a 52-1 career record, 20 wins in one season, 32 straight wins, 8 no-hitters in a season. Oh, he did that twice, by the way. His junior and senior years, he pitched 8 no-hitters, 17 no-hitters total in his high school career. And he led his high school to the state semifinals in 1958 and a championship in 1959, and pitching every inning of every postseason tournament game. So you know those Little League tournaments that you're in, Patrick?
Yeah.
You know, the good teams, they sometimes put just like one kid out there to pitch, mm-hmm. even though they really shouldn't. Yeah, that was basically Dean Chance in 1959.
Well, it was like the this season's New York Yankees, Astros, and Nationals combined.
That's right. Yeah, he basically was a one-man band on the mound. I feel pretty bad for every other pitcher on that high school team. They never got a chance, so to speak. Dean Chance, however, did get a chance, signing with the Baltimore Orioles following high school. He got a $30,000 bonus and a $12 Greyhound bus ticket. That way, he could start his professional career with the Bluefield Orioles in the Appalachian League. Now, he would move up through the Orioles farm system, but never pitched for the Orioles, as he was selected by the new Washington Senators in the 1960 American League expansion draft. Now, right after the draft, Chance was traded by the Senators to the other expansion team, the Los Angeles Angels, for outfielder Joe Hicks. He would spend some time in the minor leagues, although a very brief time, on September 11th, 1961, at the age of 20. He would make his major league debut. Now, he had a good rookie campaign in 1962, winning 14 games and earned run average of 2.96. He was actually third in American League Rookie of the Year voting. And this is the year that he teamed up with Bo Belinsky. Now, Belinsky was another pitcher in the Angels system and a little bit of a wild child.
I thought you were going to say Bo Jackson.
No, not Bo Jackson. No, that was a wild child of a different era. It's too bad that his career ended as soon as it did. Bo Belinsky, however, was much ballyhooed as going to be a great star, but he really talked the talk but never walked the walk. After Bo Belinsky got a big contract, he had a couple of good seasons here and there, but the young, attractive Bo Belinsky was more interested in the young, attractive women of the Los Angeles, California area, as was his roommate, Dean Chance. So while Chance was a star in the big leagues, like I said, winning the Cy Young Award in 1964 and going 15-10 in 1965, he was also an all-star in 1964. Even though he became a star by being linked to Bo Belinsky, who was one of the big playboys of Southern California, they spent an awful lot of time in the entertainment circles, which drove the Angels and their manager, Bill Rigney, insane. Now, after the 1966 season, the Angels looking for a few more bats in the lineup and also looking to get rid of a malcontent like Dean Chance, decided to trade him and infielder Jackie Hernandez to the Minnesota Twins in exchange for Jimmy Hall, Don Mincher, and Pete Cimino. Now, Chance would win 20 games for the Twins in 1967. He also had a rain-shortened five-inning perfect game against the Red Sox. Of course, that doesn't count anymore. He did also have a 2-1 no-hitter against the Cleveland Indians on August 25th. So he does get credited with one no-hitter in his career. He was also the starting pitcher of the final game of the 1967 season. He had a wild American League race coming down to the last game, and Chance was out-dueled by Jim Lomborg and the Boston Red Sox in that game. The Red Sox go on to win and continue their crazy season where they went on to the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, after 1967, things started going downhill for Dean Chance. He had a rather 16-16 season in 1968. And because Chance wanted to get paid, like most good ball players want to get, the rather thrifty or cheap, I guess is the better word, owner of the Twins, Calvin Griffith, decided to cut Chance's salary in the 1969 season. And that basically made him a marked man. And also starting to deal with injuries, including a back injury that was caused by him rushing to get back into shape after his holdout in 1969. The Twins were certainly rushing to get him out of town. He was traded to the New York Yankees along with Ted Uhlander and Bob Miller and some guy named Greg Nettles to the Cleveland Indians, I should say. Yep, for pitcher Stan Williams and Louis Tiant. And, of course, Nettles would go on to the Yankees and be a star with them after he was traded again a couple years later. Tiant would become a star with the Boston Red Sox a few years later. Chance in Cleveland did not do well, a 9-8 record with a 4.28 earned run average, eventually traded to the Mets, as he's photographed on the 71 Topps card after being purchased, I should say, from the Indians, not traded. He got a couple of relief innings here and there during the Mets' 1971 or 1970 pennant run, in which they ultimately fell short. And then in 1971, he was traded to the Detroit Tigers along with reliever Bill Dennehy for minor league pitcher Jerry Robertson. He was used primarily out of the bullpen and finished 4-6 after appearing in 31 games in 1971. So, Patrick, that 1971 Topps card would have been his second to last card, but the last year that he saw any major league action, believe it or not. Yeah, so you got a unique little card there. Of course, he would have a 1972 card recapping his 71 season, but that was it. After Chance retired from baseball in 1971, he went back to his boyhood farm, a 300-acre ranch. Or actually, it wasn't his farm. It was just down the road from his farm. And during the 1970s and 80s, Chance became a midway barker and an operator of skill games at carnivals and fairs. And he actually owned a big company that facilitated a lot of county fairs, the Ohio State Fair, throughout the 1970s and 80s. And he got a little tired of all the travel and all the con men that were involved in carny games such as that. He eventually founded the International Boxing Association in the 1990s. He managed many fighters. And as part of the Angels' 50th anniversary, Chance threw out the first pitch before the June 4th, 2011 game versus the New York Yankees. Chance would die at the age of 74 in October of 2015. He had one child, Brett, who graduated from Ohio State in 1985, was an executive for the Ohio State Fair and the Ohio Expo Center as well, so kind of following in his dad's footsteps. Shortly before Chance's death, he was inducted into the Angels Hall of Fame. So, Patrick, I gotta say, you picked some pretty good players there. I mean, it's all random. Like, you looked at all the cards, like nothing said, oh, I'm going to learn something interesting about that guy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, you did learn something interesting about all the players. So Danger Dan McGinn, getting the first Expos win, getting the first win for a pitcher in Canada, getting the first home run in Expos mm-hmm. history all off of Hall of Famer Tom
getting
Seaver.
The first everything.
The first everything, pretty much, yeah. Blue Moon Odom, who was the first star pitcher for the Oakland Athletics as some of their younger talent came up around them. Danny Walton, who was the ultimate example of a 4A player, although by all accounts a really good guy. And then Dean Chance, who liked to party, but coupled with his rather unique delivery as a pitcher, Mickey Mantle offered Dean Chance the ultimate compliment when Mantle said, and I think this was in 64 or 65, he said every time he saw Dean Chance as the starting pitcher, he threw up. So if Mickey Mantle says you're making him sick, you're doing something good. So Dean Chance did that. So some good choices there, my friend. Good stuff. So with all this extra homeschooling and stuff, are we going to dive into some more baseball cards?
Probably.
Yeah, I think it's a definite. We got to fill the time somehow. There's only so many podcasts we can do. And there's only so much more we can do here. A little bit of an extended podcast as we talk not only about these cards and the 71 top set and the Heritage set, checking in with our good friend Nick Deonte in New York City as well, but also reminding people during this COVID-19 crisis, which will play on for several more weeks, be smart. Listen to the experts, not your favorite political party. Listen to the doctors, listen to the health organizations, and stay inside, please. We've got plenty of podcasts for you to listen to. You've got plenty of cards to sort through, so do so wisely. We will get through this together over the following weeks and certainly months, and hopefully by this summer, late this summer, we're all emerging from this better and able to, you know, fight issues like this collectively. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. That's Patrick Salmon, my co-host. Say goodbye, Patrick.
Goodbye.
There you go. Nick Deonte, my guest, thank you so much for joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. Join us again in 2 weeks as we'll open up that faux Santa Rack Pack of 1979 Tops. We'll see you then.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.